on a bottom line basis is our surplus is about $522,000 behind where it was at this point last year. So all in, I feel pretty good that we're offsetting as much as we are, and we're able to do what we're able to accomplish on the capital side at this point in the year. So I'd call it, in the current circumstances, strong performance. When we look at the zoo, we can see that we are down $2.4 million in terms of total revenue. We are working on the second half forecast as we speak to see where we think we're going to come out this year, but obviously we're going to continue to see this number grow as the year goes on, since we are not quite, we're not operating at full capacity with restrictions on attendance and making sure we keep appropriate distances and safety. We have been able to offset $1.2 million of that shortfall by savings in operating expenses, but that leaves our operating subsidy $1.2 million higher than it was last year. So in other words, we're subsidizing $1.2 million more than we were at this point last year. We have been keeping a watchful eye on the capital spend. We've been able to offset that subsidy increase to the tune of about $577,000. Being very strategic in what capital we take on and how we're deploying outside money other than Cleveland Metro Parks. So that puts us at about $623,000 additional subsidy from where we were at halfway through last year. Jumping to golf, this is really a great story. As you can see here, our bottom line revenue number is $158,000 higher than it was last year.
Same slide.
Well, this is, this wasn't working, so I'm not, it is working now. David, whatever you did was good, so I can get us caught up on the here.
Yeah.
Very good. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Thank
you. There we are. How's that?
Thank you. Perfect.
Excellent. Do we need to go back at all? Do you want to see the zoo numbers or anything? We can go back quickly and take a look at those that we went over, just in case there's any. Okay. Okay, so we're jumping to golf, and we're on total revenue. Rounds played, in other words, greens fees and equipment rentals are both up significantly, a combined $480,000 this year, which is just remarkable. Obviously, we get some of that back, or our other lines of revenue are down, as you can see here, but we still are up $158,000 through the first half for golf's performance.
So golf is subsidizing other...
Not quite yet.
No, not quite yet. That'd be a conversation with John for sure. I don't know how that would go at this point, because we still have to worry about what impact the weather's going to have on the second half of the year. So even though it's been really strong,
being inquisitive
is good. But you look at $160,000 in revenue, and if we have two bad weeks, then we can completely go the other way. So it's a cautionary tale of success right now, but we're keeping a close eye on this as well. And you can see from a total operating expense perspective, we also are doing well here. We've saved about $350,000 versus where we were at this point last year. So that puts our operating surplus at $500,000 better than we were last year. And you'll note that at this point last year, we were not in an operating surplus position at this point. We were actually approaching it, but now we've already surpassed it. And then since we finished up a lot of the large capital projects last year, and because we have no availability to get that last order of carts that we were going to get this year, supplier issues with COVID and the related, our capital spend is down almost $1 million, $992,000 from where it was last year.
That's just deferred.
Part of that is deferred.
Yes and no, though.
The cart part's deferred, but some of it's outright savings.
Oh, wow.
We pre-bought that one fleet that came in,
yeah.
And so for the contract, we're actually letting it go. Sean has secured about 16 carts to go to Seneca because on a daily basis, we're running out. So we're picking up about 16 more to handle the influx of golfers that are there. We're running about 48 leagues, and they're pretty much running at capacity right now. So we're kind of buffering that, so we'll hold that one true, and then we'll pick up that last fleet for the contract.
That last contract amount, if I remember correctly, was about $274,000. So we had originally thought we were going to do that this year, but that's the piece that's deferred into next.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For the car purchase. And then here we can see from an individual course perspective. You may recall from the last meeting that we had, a lot of our courses were either yellow or red, which means we weren't performing quite to where we were at this point last year in revenue and operating margin or both. You can now see that all of our courses here, with the exception of Mastic and Washington Park, are better in both revenue and operating margin than they were last year. And these two courses, Mastic Woods And Washington, Mastic, we started later. In Washington, we opened the driving range much later this year. So they're actually performing pretty well, also in the positive in terms of operating margin, just less time in the season than we had at this point last year, which is why those are in the yellow at this point. As we move to our enterprise team, total revenue is down about $1.6 million, obviously with the number of things that were closed for the majority of first half or that remain closed now. That really affects the concessions number, as well as the other number, which has a lot to do with Ledge Lake and some of our amenities that are summertime related that we have not opened.
May I interject?
Sure.
The question, because it's sort of how we are surfing this wave, because we were opening. Now we're, are we the clam in the aquarium that's got a...
It's less clam, more Bob and Weave, depending on what's happening and how we, so like Hinkley Lake Boathouse and East 55th and Emerald Necklace. And so each one of those areas have had some operational challenges due to COVID. So we've been managing through that. We've limited the amount of attendance coming into the zoo, ticket sales with Asian Lantern Night. So we've done lots of different things across the board, essentially.
We're trying to keep it operational as much as we can and realistically.
Realistically, I mean, considering we're down about 1,000 seasonals from last year and we've got, you know, 650 people in various states of furlough or layoff. So we're trying to do everything we can to sustain where we're at. But as Bill said, that 1.1 and kind of the earned revenue side of things, you know, equates for lots of different special events. I would say runs and walks that aren't happening. Picnic pavilion rentals. I mean, there's a whole host of things that get added into that, like over time. Let's still being closed.
And then just to segue, anecdotally, as far as enforcement issues, I mean, assuming we see a spike in people filing complaints and all, what's the pattern here?
Filing complaints as in?
Not wearing masks, people congregating, I mean, stuff that we were getting earlier, that's just pretty well.
A lot of those are actually, believe it or not, going to the health departments right now. I would say in general, we do get periodically.
Like restaurants, town hall is an example, where they're just getting flooded with Board of Health is getting flooded.
I would say, I mean, one of the successes of Metro Parks has been that we've been open through this entire pandemic. I would also say that, you know, all of the guidelines and the signage and everything that we've done has definitely helped. I can also say that almost everyone I've talked to, which is a lot of people, they're using the parks and they're using them regularly and they're using them often. They're using them at different times. So we're seeing lots of positive there because they can be out and socially distant. But we're also trying not to promote, you know, gatherings or congregation areas, you know, throughout the park district as well. So it's a huge challenge to manage through. And I can tell you that the teams across the board, whether it be from the park operations side to the Teamsters, everybody is in all in this together, and we're all working through it. We've had to move employees around to be successful in a lot of different areas, so people are out of their job duties and classifications and normal schedule, but we're doing everything we can to keep people on the payroll and keep the park district moving.
Thanks for putting it.
We're not seeing a spike in crime.
We actually are not, because I think there's so many people using the park. There are so many more eyes on the park, and the police department has done a fantastic job. Great example is the 4th of July. Yes, but this 4th of July, I don't think there were any arrests. There were no arrests at Edgewater Park, so they managed through the 4th of July, which is normally a little bit more. It's just, you know, the crowd fills up at Edgewater and other locations to watch the fireworks. And this year, there were no arrests and very few citations. So, speeding, we've picked up more speeders this year. I think with the advent of the park district, you know, they tended to accelerate just a little bit more. So we've been a little bit more vigilant in that. Parking ticket revenue. Yeah, they make it a little easier to get through. So, and I would also say one of the areas, enforcement on the boat ramps has gone up as well.
Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, not at all. Any questions? Okay, so because we are at $1.6 million less revenue, we've also taken some steps to try and offset the ability with our operating expenses here, being very cautious in what we're doing. So we're down about $900,000 from an operating expense standpoint. Now, some of this is what we would normally be buying for retail, food and beverage merchandise, but a lot of it is also, as you can see here, is related to salaries. Brian mentioned the reduced seasonal this year. That load, a lot of that does come through here, but our all-out operations, we're being very conservative on everything that we're doing, and Joe and his team continue to do a good job crimping down and making sure there's no unnecessary spend. Where this takes us is we are $661,000behind where we were last year. We're actually in a subsidy position right now of $144,000 versus the $500,000 that we were surplus we were at last year. But again, it's an effort to balance what we can truly open and open safely versus what we would have to open, close, which we don't want to do from a public interaction guest experience perspective or from a staffing perspective. So we're being very deliberate and we're trying to get things open and get revenue flowing. So on a net basis, this takes us to $642,000 off of where we were at this point last year, which we'll continue to monitor this very closely. And on a per location basis, we can see here, obviously we have still no revenue in the locations that we haven't opened up yet. Emerald Necklace Marina, this is a timing benefit that is outperforming last year, but it is and it's helping us both in revenue and margin. Wildwood Marina, I will say, I'm happy to say, is operating at break even. You can see when we took that over and started it last year, at this point we had a $25,000 subsidy, and right now we're at break even at Wildwood. And then the rest of our locations through various states of when we've been able to open and do anything with them, obviously Beach House is affected by not having Edgewater Live, not having the upstairs open, E55th restaurant, delayed start, grab and go, patio only. So you can see this cascades through all of our operations. Then when we move to our remaining locations, again, we've got some of those that are not generating any revenue or not much to speak of. And we can see here that Huntington Beach actually does have more operating surplus than it did at this point last year, even though the revenue is down. So this shows some of the timing of food and beverage purchases for resale, as well as the operational control to try to keep expenses down. And you can see at our other locations here, the Pier, Wallace, and parking. The Pier and Wallace, obviously, we opened those much later than we did last year. We had those closed to the beginning part of the season, and parking is strictly coincides with the diminished traffic downtown. So lack of events, lack of people, lack of parking. So we're managing through all this to the best of our abilities and keeping a steady eye on cash. I think we reforecast our cash position on basically a weekly basis. We're running numbers all the time and making sure that that we're keeping good track of that, especially with the light of like getting tax revenues at September 30 as opposed to July and August this year. So that's where we came out through first half. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Bruce, I just want to mention, we didn't have audio for the first couple minutes of the start of this meeting. Just for the public to know that we did the Pledge of Allegiance, we adopted the minutes of the board meeting, and then we went into Bill's financial report. So nothing substantive was lost. I'm not sure it will be available even in the recorded version. So I just want the public to know that there were no discussions or deliberations that they missed.
Thank you. All right, we're done?
Yes.
Brian?
Very good. Good morning, everyone. The first action item we have is budget adjustment number 6 for the 2020 budget.
Thank you, Brian. Budget adjustment number 6 is for $47,720. It is comprised mostly of a Cleveland Foundation grant, a new grant that we received. It's broke up into two parts, A and B up here above, a little bit over $20,000, and then another $17,000 of restricted funds balance. Now designated for use to make up the majority of that $47,720. An explanation of the adjustments by category are on pages 25 to 26, and the net adjustment of $47,720, the adoption of the budget adjustments, the recommended action on the bottom of page 9.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item we have is the increase for the Marks radio system for the police. We have been operating under an agreement that was awarded in two-year increments. The contract would automatically renew. The annual cost is about $10 per device. There's 187 devices throughout the year, depending on operability, with an annual cost of about $22,320. The police will essentially continue to operate through the Marks radio system for at least the next 10 years. instead of continuing to come back, we are asking the board to approve essentially the next 10 years, which is about the lifespan of our current radio system. And the amount of the revised contract is $288,260 for the police radio system.
Move approval of the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. The next is a continuation of Chief Dolan's work to actually get mutual aid agreements and intergovernmental cooperative agreements. This next one is with the City of Bedford Heights. Again, the board has seen a number of these throughout the most recent board agendas, and this is just the continuation to try to get all the communities that we continue to serve. So the recommended action falls in the mid portion of page 11.
I move the approval of the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the additional revisions for adoption for the Cleveland Metro Parks Codified Rules Regulations in 2020. Rose?
Thank you, Ryan. This is just, we had a couple additional items. We got final word from Ohio Department of Natural Resources that we could not require a fishing license for those inland lakes that are not connected to the state waterways. And the fishing license, they would not be required, which would help with our programming for folks who don't have a fishing license. So we decided to make this change in our code.
So it's an exemption.
Exactly. And so Mike Dirkwood did an excellent job of working with ODNR and basically ushering this change through, which will very much improve our access to programming. So we're very thankful for Mike's work on that. The next change is we're going to add a more specific provision to our aggravated trespass regulation. This is in large part due to some of the increasing, shall we say, boldness of patrons at zoos across the nation in accessing our habitats of the animals. And so we felt that this in many respects mirrors the Ohio Revised Code for an aggravated trespass in zoo-like and entertainment districts like at Cedar Point and other venues. This just gives our code more clarity in upping the charge, a more serious consequence, as we're seeing more of these brazen acts which jeopardize the safety of the animal as well as the patron who chooses to disregard all of the warnings. So we're going to increase the charge to that M1 status. And then finally, just the cleanup of eliminating section 311.02. Since we have a very comprehensive permit process now, which is contained in chapter 747, this standalone section regarding parades and assemblages basically is not necessary and redundant and conflicting with our comprehensive permit process.
Got a question going back to the aggravated trespass. First three misdemeanor now, what is the monetary fine?
$1,000.
Still just $1,000?
Yeah, and a 6-month penalty, perhaps prison sentence though too.
At the end of the day, what is it we want to achieve? Is obviously a deterrent,
yeah,
as far as the punishment. Do we have any discussion as far as what we will, in other words, monetary?
So, I mean, I think our prosecutor would ask for the max. I think the deterrent of the jail time is you know, what we're looking for.
Sure.
And so we just need this to be treated with more seriousness.
Are you looking at being more punitive on the?
I guess it's a policy, yeah. Is there a question where, I mean, jail time should be a deterrent for anyone, but I'm just throwing it out.
Yeah.
Is there any thought of?
Well, I mean, if.
Almost a transactional cost, but it takes to be able to address the situation.
Well, the current status right now is very much a transactional, you know, so that's the need to make this change.
Sure.
Have the threat of jail time. So I think that if we want to talk about felony, we certainly, I mean, if, you know, we can further study that.
I guess the question is the only way it penalizes to track the revised code, or is there something that we can layer onto it as almost a civil kind of.
That's what I was thinking.
If we even want to do that, I'm not sure.
Yeah, certainly if there's harm to an employee or our animal, right, we would look at layering and triggering other aspects.
That's going to be case by case, judge's discretion problem.
The next action item is authorization of a land acquisition and an acceptance of land donation. This is to the Board of Education for the city of Euclid. This is something that actually started back in 1965. The city of Euclid, the school district, essentially bought with a reverter clause in the language that if the said public school, it could only be used for school purposes. If such land is abandoned for those purposes, the land ceases to be used for those purposes. For any other purposes, the ownership actually reverts back to Cleveland Metro Parks. City of Euclid passed their bond issue back in November of 2016. They are in the phasing of consolidating the school district. We are also working with them closely on the demolition. You can see the map there. So not only are we picking up the 5.4-acre parcel of that, we're going to add the additional acres of about 12 to the whole site there. They're actually working on the demolition plan very closely with Sean. They hope to have that done this fall, hopefully. We will also be applying for a GLRI grant to fund the restoration and reforestation of this particular property. So here's kind of the conceptual look. It does have connections to Chardon Road and Euclid. We've decided to leave a small little pull-off parking lot there. It is traffic signaled, so it does make some sense. And then essentially we'll be looking at potentially a tree, a deer exclosure fence around to reforest the particular area and buffer the shores of the Euclid Creek. A great opportunity to add some additional acres in the city of Euclid with the wisdom of the board back in 1965 to use the reverter clause for the purposes. Recommend action falls if there are no questions on the bottom portion.
Can I ask one question? Why did the city of Euclid not repurpose the building? I mean, it's great, of course, terrific, but
I don't know that I can speak to their consolidation plan.
It would be the city. Yeah, the school district.
Yeah, it was the school, the city school district. I will also tell you that in Broadview and Brecksville, the combined school district there, it seems there's lumpers and splitters in administration. People lump people together, they split people apart and make smaller pods. Right now, it seems to be a consolidation. City of North Royalton is also doing the same thing, taking a lot of their smaller schools that have basically, in their minds, maybe become obsolete or too challenging or too expensive, which Commissioner Rinker had stated, and actually combining them together. So Broadview, Brecksville is doing it, North Royalton is doing it, City of Euclid is doing it, and others are kind of consolidating. So that seems to be what they're doing currently.
Second.
All in favor?
The next action item is the fourth lease amendment with the West Creek Conservancy to add plus or minus 52 acres. The reservation was created back in 2006. We are now committed to more land activities with the West Creek and the city of Parma. These are very many parcels that you can see that Derek has threaded together throughout the entire process. The goal is, this is the West Ridgewood to Grantwood connection, furthering going north. There's also one more map that actually takes us over into, so you can see how linear the reservation has become. So the additional acres include, at some point in time, Parmadale, which will come over from the city of Parma. Also, the continuation to work with Padua High School and the diocese to pick up Camp Cord Gray area. So that is in process. But then this also then does extend east, actually into Seven Hills. So we will be actually adding land in Seven Hills for the first time, and then the ultimate goal that this connection will be threaded down through Independence and then eventually through to the towpath or into the Independence kind of the recreational complex there. So this is a continuation of adding the acres and the vision to connect West Creek to the Cuyahoga to the Cuyahoga River. Again, I'd like to thank Derek Schaefer and the entire board of the West Creek Conservancy for their hard and dedicated work, as well as our real estate team, because they have to go through each and every one of these transactions to validate them before they are turned over, and they were approved by Anthony J. Russo for the donation. So thank you very much. That was the last general action item, tabulation of award and bid. There actually are none. This may be the first time in my 10 years that has actually happened. Vouchers and payroll.
Thank you, Brian. The following vouchers have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity to the Ohio Revised Code, totaling $10,321,670.87. And the recommended action is that the Board of Park Commissioners approves this resolution number 20-07-098.
You can move. Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Information?
Actually, public comments.
Oh, that's right.
If we can get them.
Unintentional.
David, are there any?
I'm not saying anything in the chat, but Marty, you are unmuted if you have anything that you'd like to add for public comment. I've got a text that she is trying to connect. She has an audio connection and is unmuted. I don't know if any communication through the event. She has texted Anthony that she's trying, but I'm not getting any activity in the event itself.
Thank you for coming. I have a call to stop on the speaker.
Volume's up. No incoming audio.
I would defer to you.
Did you text the rose?
I texted Anthony. I don't have Marty's cell phone.
Oh.
So I texted Anthony Joy, who she texted Anthony Joy.
Okay, yeah, it looks like she's now called in. I'm installing user 8. And
in user 8. I'm here now.
Okay.
Good morning.
Okay, are we ready? Can you hear me?
We can hear you, but we're getting a lot of feedback. Let me try to mute your other connection.
Are we clear now?
Yeah, that's thank you.
I can't tell what that last comment was.
Yes, go ahead, Marty. We're ready for your comment.
Okay, thank you. Obviously, these days, you need to be reducing costs and raising revenues. There is ostensibly a hiring freeze in effect. While long-time experienced, skilled employees are relegated to scrubbing golf carts, at least two additional highly paid hires have been brought in. Dan Crandall, who left Cleveland Metro Parks, is now back at Big Met, and a replacement for Brendan McHugh was hired. Golf and marketing are already very heavily staffed and presumably could have picked up any slack. Leadership Council training is hardly essential at the moment, and $6,000 could be used elsewhere. Plenty of plaques already on the walls. There is a $12,000 charge regarding a zip line at the zoo. We are in an unprecedented time and don't know what the future holds. Help me to understand why Metro Parks would want to pursue something like a Soaring Eagle zip line, which is better suited to the IX Center than the zoo. If this was not a priority in the past, it certainly isn't now. Many projects, the 4D Theater and Go Ape, for example, were supposed to be moneymakers but haven't panned out. Even as I suspect their in-house expenses for advertising and environmental damage may not have been charged back. Initial construction for this zip line seems to be over $300,000 elsewhere, hardly insignificant. Add in insurance, ticketing, utilities, plus lots of disinfecting supplies and labor for COVID precautions. Look at what was poured into redoing the Emerald Necklace restaurant, still waiting to turn a profit, much less recoup those expenses. The Gorilla Project is huge, but deserves support and funding. You promote and feature conservation, so put your money and efforts there. Really a shame to carefully design an attractive park and then plop down something ugly and out of place like that Soaring Eagle thing. Don't negate decades of careful planning with some ill-considered amusement park gimmick. Tough times require careful choices, which won't leave regrets later. Act in haste, regret at leisure. Thank you and stay safe.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else?
No other comments.
Okay, moving on for information and briefing.
The first information item is the 2019 going into 2020 Cleveland Metro Parks Volunteer Services Report. This morning we have Lynn Lisner, our Director of Volunteer Services, and Harold Harris here for both.
Thank you.
Hello.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share volunteer services. So I'm going to quickly review 2019, even though it sounds like 5 years ago, it really was only last year. We're also going to share with you our results for our 2020 volunteer engagement survey. And then lastly, we're going to talk about how volunteers are supporting Cleveland Metro Parks during the pandemic. 2019, volunteer services focused on our core values. Just like staff, volunteers are required to uphold the same standards of behavior. So primarily guest focus is what we worked on. And also 2019 was our year of increased engagement. You're going to hear that word a lot today. Engaged volunteers, that is the epitome of every volunteer program. So in 2019, 5,700 volunteers donated 137 hours of their time to our organization. And that equates to about $3.3 million for Cleveland Metro Parks, which is the estimated value of volunteer time as determined by independent directors. So my two favorite stats over 2019 was our 12% increase in new volunteers over the previous year. So that means we're engaging the public and we're bringing together more advocates for our organization. And also, average hours per ongoing volunteer is 67, which is an increase over last year. So just to put that in perspective, we require 10 hours per volunteer per year to remain active. So our average is 67. That's pretty amazing. And what that tells us is we are offering fulfilling opportunities for volunteers. They feel they are contributing to our mission. They feel appreciated. And you know, we're very happy that they're willing to give us so much of their time. So on the table below, you can see the ongoing volunteers and the ongoing volunteer hours. Both of those, we see an increase over last year. And where we see a slight decrease is in our episodic efforts. And that's due to inclement weather in the early spring. However, Katie Rivette, our coordinator for that, groups and so forth, She did a great job bringing in groups over the past year, such as KeyBank, and showed them like to support us. But if you look at our total hours for 2019, 137,000, that's actually an increase of 4% over the previous year. So what that means is we're doing more with less volunteers because our volunteers are engaged. And if you'd like to see additional information about our hours, they are listed in our annual report, which is on our webpage. So in early 2020, we completed our second volunteer engagement survey. And we sent it out to 1,600 of our ongoing volunteers, and we have a 33% response rate, which is average for that type of survey. So our demographics, they're pretty much the same as the previous year, with predominantly female over the age of 65. But if you see the next area, 71% volunteer for other organizations. So that means we have very caring, civic-minded individuals with a high opportunity to spread positive word of mouth. And in this area, how long do they volunteer for Cleveland Metro Park? 32% are new volunteers that have been with us 0 to 2 years. So what that means is we're bringing in new ideas, new voices, new ways of doing things. So we're very excited that we're engaging the community to become volunteers. But the good thing about that as well is we're retaining our volunteers. So 50% have been with us five plus years. So not only are we bringing in volunteers, we're able to retain our long-term. And then lastly, how often do you volunteer with the Metro Park? 46% volunteer with us on a weekly basis. That is amazing. That is amazing, the dedication that we have. And the top three reasons why volunteers choose Cleveland Metro Park, this didn't change over last year, mainly are, our top reason why volunteers choose Cleveland Metro Park to donate their time is our mission. They want to contribute to bettering their community. And they want to do it in a healthy way. They want to get outside and exercise. They're health conscious. And third, they want to volunteer to learn more, but also to share the knowledge that they've acquired over the years. 92% of our volunteers would recommend Cleveland Metro Park to a friend as a place to volunteer. And this has gone up from 88% in 2019. 88% feel they're making a positive contribution to Cleveland Metro Park's mission. And this also went up over last year. And 90% of our volunteers feel appreciated for their volunteer work, which went up from 81%. Why, you ask? Yeah, get to that question. The reason, part of the reason why these numbers have gone up is because our focus on engagement and creating new touch points with our volunteers. We are going out and hiking with them. We are shadowing them in their jobs. We're going out of the field and seeing what they're doing. We're asking them their opinion on how we can update the program. We're giving them a voice. We are conducting focus groups before making any changes. So we're really including them in any process that we have. Those are ones out there in the field. And then most importantly, these numbers have gone up because our 50 plus staff members, which are also volunteer coordinators, other duties are assigned, they do an amazing job of making volunteers feel part of the Cleveland Metro Park family. So we can thank all those staff members. And even any staff member that says thank you to our volunteers and smiles to them. So this is the part where I would invite volunteers to come in and give their point of view. So instead, we took some quotes from our 2020 volunteer engagement survey. I'm honored to serve as a volunteer. Thank you for giving us opportunity to have fun while providing an important service. I feel like Cleveland Metro Park is doing an amazing job, and I'm loving the experience I'm getting with the volunteer program. You're doing a great job. I'm proud to be a volunteer. Actual quotes. Okay, so volunteers, when you engage volunteers, you're engaging the community. 30% of our volunteers have donated to Blue Lumachi Park financially. 69% of our volunteers have attended a Blue Lumachi Park free program or event. 53% have paid to attend a Cleveland Metro Parks attraction program or event, and 84% of our volunteers have recommended attractions, programs, or events to family and friends. So even when they're not volunteering, our volunteers are our audience, and they're also our advocates. So during the onset of COVID-19, we had to suspend our volunteer program temporarily. And even though volunteers were not out physically in the field, we still engaged them through virtual opportunities, virtual connections. We had some coffee chats via Zoom, and we also enlisted them to create maps for us, for staff and other volunteers. And then once safety measures were in place, we were able to resume volunteer activities May 4th. And we focused on volunteer activities that were outdoors and that can be done virtually. And 44% of our volunteers have returned out of 1,700 folks. The main purpose of bringing back volunteers during this time was to support staff and maintain our level of quality customer service. So volunteers made 1,300 masks for staff and volunteers. I actually am wearing one that one of our volunteers made. It has Elvis. Elvis's face on it. One of my favorites. Sorry, folks at home, you cannot see. But Sylvia, she made 200 masks on her own. So 83 volunteers wanted to come back and help us with trash collection. So 83 folks came out and contributed 304 hours of their time to support the park and clean up trash. And 50 of our volunteers came back to lend a hand with vault operations. So we're very happy that they're dedicated enough to come back. And two of our largest volunteer programs, Zoo and Trail Ambassadors, they have both seen overwhelming support from our volunteers during this time. So Cruise to Zoo, during that event, 1,143 volunteer hours were donated. That's 23 volunteer shifts per day of this entire event, equivalent to $27,000. And James and Carrie both did an excellent job of connecting with those volunteers that were not willing to come back. You know, we have the largest demographic of our volunteers are in that risk category. So for the folks that couldn't come back, we offered some virtual conservation opportunities, which they gave 568 virtual hours, which included the 367 universe project. But we engaged them through continuing education opportunities online. And then of course, they're continuing to support the zoo with regular operations, including the Asian Lantern Festival. And the Trail Ambassadors. So obviously, we've seen an increase in park usage, and now more than ever, our Trail Ambassadors can help. They are the eyes, the ears, and the smiles of the park. I did not make that up. That was coined by one of our lovely volunteers, but it's so apropos. So we were able to modify the Trail Ambassador program by eliminating the need to go to lock box. Because what they did in the past, they would go to the lock boxes at the different reservations, sign out the equipment, backpacks and hip packs, and then they would go out on their shift. And then the next person would use the same equipment. So we modified the program and supplemented folks with their personal supplies. And so this allows the volunteers to go to parks that are not tied down by lock boxes. And we're able to overlap shifts, so there's more coverage. And because we were able to modify that program, 77% of our Trail Ambassadors felt safe enough to return. Yeah. Yes, and Liz Pease did a great job of training those volunteers the new way of doing things. So she did that virtually. And then also she conducted many coffee chat social hours to stay connected, to answer any questions, to make sure folks felt comfortable enough to come out.
Are we able to add new trail ambassadors, or is that too challenging?
Well, unfortunately, we had to halt that, bringing them in new, but we told them that, you know, as soon as things open up, we'll be able to. And we actually think that providing virtual training to supplement regular training with virtual training will open the doors and allow more people to join us, which we're excited about. Because it's definitely a need.
Yes.
Right. So since coming back, we received a lot of positive feedback from our volunteers. You know, they say it's their home away from home, and they're so glad to be back and to feel useful again and stay engaged. You know, we do tell folks that, you know, it's on their own terms when they do feel comfortable to come back. But volunteers are a vital part of our organization, and through volunteering, especially during this time, we're a vital part of their life too. So to be able to offer volunteer opportunities during this time is wonderful. You know, the fact that, you know, I don't see a lot of coworkers now. If you think of some of our volunteers who only communicate when they come out and volunteer, maybe they don't have somebody at home to talk with. You know, we are their family, and to offer volunteer opportunities during this time, it's definitely positive for our organization. That's all I have. Any other questions I can answer?
Very true.
That's terrific.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Harold. And again, thank you, commissioners, because you are all volunteers as well. We appreciate it. So we'll give you a nice little thank you. It is really nice to see all of our trail ambassadors and volunteers get a chance to get back into the swing of things. The next information item, which will be dominated by Sean going forward, is the Irish Town Bend structure demolition.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm glad to be back in front of you in person this morning. So we've got a very brief update on Irish Town Bend and the structure demolition associated with Irish Town Bend. So just to give you a quick background here, Irish Town Bend is the focus of more than 10 organizations who have come together to see that this 25-acre-plus park plus hillside stabilization moves forward. So it's been some good momentum lately. Specifically, we have been involved in assisting on some demolitions of two structures. So we have both former CMHA-owned properties, now owned by West Creek Conservancy through an LLC, as they are a landholding and takedown partner as part of the larger cooperative that is the Irish Town Bend Group. Specifically, two structures. We've got the Big Creek structure here, which is a former multifamily structure, and then the now former CMHA headquarters buildings. These buildings were purchased with Clean Ohio funds through a grant provided to Land Studio, and then with those funds came additional funds for demolition of those structures themselves. So just to give you an idea of what those structures look like, this is that Big 8 structure right here, and then this is the former CMHA building right here. So what our involvement involves is just demolition, and these are funds that are provided through Clean Ohio. They are not Metro Parks funds. We find that we get good competitive pricing, and we can deliver a good project as a partner to the larger fund. So from there, the port will then work on further stabilization of the hillside after the demolition is done.
CMHA is a partner as well, correct?
CMHA has been a great partner in that the vast majority of the hillside, all this land was owned by CMHA, and in working through HUD, was able to transfer it to Riverbed West, which is West Creek Conservancy LLC.
I think just as a point of clarification too, Metro Parks didn't seek this out. This was something that as a partner organization, we do a number of demolitions throughout the park district throughout the years, and it was just an economy of scale. So that's how we ended up essentially partnering with this group, and certainly we want to get the hill stabilized as soon as possible to finish the last leg of the trail along Irishtown Bend.
That's great.
To Brian's point, the fund, the $3.335 million through congestion mitigation and air quality funds is sitting there waiting to go to construct that last portion of the Cleveland Foundation Centennial Lake Green Trail on Irishtown.
So this is the last step before that?
There are actually many intermediary steps between demolition of these structures and the construction of the trail. The port has to stabilize the hillside. They've got a very good start on funding for stabilization of the hillside. They don't have every dollar needed yet.
Budget for that?
Potentially $40 million. There's about $27 million or so secured right now. They are working with Osborne Engineers, who's extremely capable, and they're working to find ways to make it as economic as possible to do the stabilization.
When will the demo take place?
When will
the demo take place?
Our intent is to have these buildings down by the end of the year.
Okay.
Sean, one of the things that puzzles me, if you walk up on that hillside underneath these two buildings, you'll find it extremely wet. And by wet, I mean non-glossy boots. What's happening is, anytime you get the hydraulic effect of water and loose earth, and that's what's happening there. There's been no attempt to just diagonally cut trenches and drain it, obviously avoiding the sewer line, but just to drain it back into the river.
Sean has the answer to this. He's waiting to go.
Yes. You can't do that thing. The Ohio Department of Transportation has a project that they have been working on for some time.
2 years.
To do exactly what you're describing, and that is draining this portion of hillside here. There is some pretty unique infrastructure, old access to what you could call a subway on the Detroit Superior Viaduct. There have been, let's just say, ovations to potentially leaking water mains. There is an incredible amount of study that's going on to this part of the hillside. And ODOT has committed about $1 million to construct drainage facilities in that location. That is part of the overall project.
I think just to add to it, when the original Tiger grant got put together, there was a conversation to try to tie in components of this with the City of Cleveland and a host of others. It didn't necessarily work exactly in the big meeting, but what it did is it brought all of the interested parties together, and this is approximately 3 years ago now, and ODOT realized that they had some work, and I think what's great about this is that there are so many people, so many hands that are actually involved in this to do each one of their components.
So like
right, it really is, and it's a matrix to get through. So, you know, the port's doing their work, West Creek stepped in, CMHA stepped in, City of Cleveland stepped in, Metro Park stepped in, Cuyahoga County is involved, ODOT is involved. So there's a host of people that have had to stack up, but then what that means is it's got them all together, and now everybody's got kind of marching orders to get certain things done. They realized that there was a pipe broken, and I forget the inch diameter, but they essentially had separated, so it was running unabated, coming off the bridge right through the property without connections down. So to your point, you would literally sink inside of the hill, and so those areas are now being addressed as part of this project because they realized that they actually own those.
In Colorado, they'll be where you have an angle of repose a little steeper than it should be. You'll have whole hills that come down. And the first thing you do, and this is by the first thing you do, this is 20 years ago, this is 5 years ago, you just cut diagonal in. And you, the only problem here was to get over the sewer line so you don't compromise the sewer line. Not a problem since the road is closed.
Also, to tie in the sewer district's work, which was not mentioned, I think Sean can add to that, the work that they're doing to redo one of the forest mains that goes to the westerly sewer treatment facility.
Sewer district has been a very, very strong partner in this whole effort. In fact, part of their work to reconstruct that interceptor sewer along the bank of the river is they have committed additional funds that after they match to those federal funds that are part of that infra grant that was received for Irish Town Bend. So the sewer district has been very committed to
that. They've been generalized as a hill is wet. It begins to slide, mm-hmm. and then it slides over the road where the sewer is lying. And then it breaks the pipe. And so that's been, but to not attack that immediately, it's just, to me, I just, and maybe it's who was running it in the beginning, the city of Cleveland, I guess, that responsibility of it.
It's a complex situation here with so many overlapping owners, but now the ownership is being solidified into one party. We can finally start to answer those questions and address them.
So another question, what happens to the land where the buildings are being demolished? Will that be a place where you can access the hillside? Will it be a public park on 125th? Will it be a building site?
We are working collectively with the larger group on planning for the larger park. To answer your question specifically, because Clean Ohio funds were used for the acquisition and demolition of these two properties, they will be public spaces with traffic uses. And that's not too dissimilar to what Metrodome has done in the past.
Correct. Gotcha.
Specifically for the time in between of demolition and programmed public use, they will be seeded.
Sure.
Seeded and then maintained, not by Metro Parks, by likely West Creek or Ohio City. Ohio City has been a great partner here, Land Studio, great
NOACA.
NOACA has so many. More than 10 partners.
What about the building at the Hart Corner of Detroit?
That is privately owned.
Now it's the whole community is living up in the home community. You go up there and they're mad at the tenants and all kinds of stuff.
And we have worked with several coalitions on in a dignified manner with compassion, making sure that the homeless population here, the unhoused population in the area, has been provided opportunities, many which have been taken to have some move to permanent supportive housing and other options.
There's also pretty good work on Franklin Road, actually moving parts of the road as part of this.
Cuyahoga County is actually in design right now for their several million dollar project to actually realign Franklin with Franklin. So that is in the works, and those design plans are underway. They've been great in sharing some renditions with us, and we've provided some feedback because our connection to Redwood Greenway is right here. So you can see how this all starts to come together.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Piece of cake.
Yep.
The next information item we have, we will move into Garfield Pond Restoration. This is in the Garfield Park Restoration. It's really interesting history. The park opened back in 1894 by the City of Cleveland. In its annual report, the City of Cleveland Board of Park Commissioners talked about it being as the most attractive in general diversity and beauty in a real natural park in itself. It's a really unique piece of property. Metro Parks has embarked on a planning and operational and capital plan to redo, renovate, restore through a host of partners. So Sean will give us some updates on where we're at with that and tying in some of our fundraising opportunities through our development group.
Got a lot of slides here, so I'm going to move quick, but let me know if you have questions. So very quickly, Garfield Park, as you heard from Brian, we have been the lessor of this land since 1986. We've also seen it grow from 145 acres to about 219. Because we don't let plans sit on the shelf, we have recently updated our master plans, and as recently as 2017. In that master plan, we paid a lot of attention to the heart of the park here with improvements to Garfield Pond and then Iron Springs. So real quick, I'm going to give you an update on Iron Springs. As we internally did a lot of good design with planning and design team and operations, and then operations and trades, construction trades are almost done with the installation of the Iron Springs shelter up there on just to the southeast of the southwest of the pond, and their work is just amazing. The craftsmanship is amazing. So then now that we've got Iron Springs starting to be buttoned up here, we're now concentrating efforts on the pond. With the pond, we're looking at highlighting some of that historic, those historic pond elements, working on restoration of Wolf Creek, and then from the programming side, looking at outdoor recreation and creating these fishing and paddle sport trial type of areas. So real quick, you heard from Brian about the history of the park, and looking back at the photos between 1911 and 1920, there's this sense of grandeur in the park. Bowditch out of Boston did the design. He did lots of really impactful park designs throughout the country, including Rockefeller Park. So it's nice to see that we have that kind of history here in Parkfield. What we can still see today are some of those remembrances. We've got the beautiful stone bridge. We've got some ruins here of a former dam, and I'll walk through that in a second. But we want to start to bring back some of those historical aspects of the park. Our crew has done some amazing work in restoring some of the walls next to some of the historic steps that connect the pond to Iron Springs. Jim Robson's crew fought by these big rods and with tensioners to literally turn this wall about 15 to 20 degrees to bring it back to and reconstruct portions of the steps. It's just an amazing craftsmanship that they've done out on the site. This gives you an idea, too, of, again, an existing footbridge. And then on the right, you can see an old wall where the upper pond used to be. And I'll give you some background on that in just a second. So I want to look really quick before the ponds were constructed. So 1890, we had Wolf Creek coming through the site, and we had Mills, Mill Creek here on the north. The ponds were constructed in the late 1800s. There were two ponds constructed. The lower pond was about 2.5 acres. The upper pond was just larger than 2.5 acres. In 2019, those ponds were gone. So what happened in the intermediate time? Let's look at a quick aerial from 1957. You can see here that we still have the lower ponds, but the upper pond is gone. Our assumptions here are that post-war development in Garfield Heights and then in the areas around, that was done with outdoor water controls that we have in modern times to prevent siltation and off-site runoff. And you can see clearly what happens when you don't control those kind of things. So by 1957, the upper pond was gone, lower pond was starting to silt in, and then by the time we get back to in the mid-90s, the lower pond is completely gone. So what we're proposing is to bring back that lower pond at 2.25 acres, and we pushed really hard to make that pond as large as possible, but doing so with modern efforts. So how does that compare to existing ponds throughout the park? Judges Lake, 2 acres. Waterfall Lake at the bottom of the hill that we're sitting atop, 2.5 acres. Strawberry Pond, 2 acres. What that tells you is we can, these are sizable ponds that you can get good programming out of, and they just don't feel like a lily pond. They actually mean something, and they're usable and impactful. So what we're looking to do here, this is the master plan, the concept plan that we've developed for the areas. Bring back fishing docks, have a small program center, have an area to launch a boat or a kayak and provide teaching for those triad-type programs. Reconstruct the historic bridge and spillway. It doesn't need a lot of work, it's just some TLC. And then this Wolf Creek and stream pond interface we'll talk about really quickly. We've got trail enhancements we'd like to make along the pond. We want to build an overlook deck and walk. We want to bring some recognition to this historic casting platform. And then we've got that opportunity where the upper pond was to restore the stream and institute some additional wetland complexes there. This is the trail network you can see. It may look busy on paper, but once you get out there, we've really got a really well-developed, interconnected network of trails around the pond. And we see a lot of use out here and want to make sure that we make that we do this right. We know we love loops, so we can get almost a 3/4 mile loop around the pond. Right now, the piece here on the southeast portion of the pond is missing, so that's a really, really crucial part that we make sure that we can include in the plans. Here's an idea of what we can do with these trails. Upper right-hand corner, this shows you this casting platform where people in the late 1800s, early 1900s learned how to fly fish. That's important because we want to bring back that element to this new restored Garfield Pond. And as we talked about the ability to institute new bridges and new trails and pathways from the north and south of the pond. And then, very importantly, the stream pond interface. The sewer district is a major funder of this project, being that our stormwater funds and our agreement with them can bring over several million dollars of funds to this project. But one of the things that they were very serious about was they wanted to make sure that Wolf Creek no longer flowed directly into the pond. They wanted to be able to have the stream operate independent of the pond. And that is very important. We agree with them on that. But there are several reasons, and if you look at new subdivision design, you a lot of times find that developers are not permitted, nor do you want them to expand a creek to flow into a pond to provide stormwater management. There are several reasons. One is fish passage, because if you impound the creek, you can no longer have fish passage. Two is water quality. We see that the highest quality streams are those that are typically cold water streams. If you connect the stream to a pond, and that pond, you know, ponds don't have typically tree cover, then you get higher temperatures of water, which leads to more algal bloom, algal growth, and then other ecological problems that are related to water health. So we found that we could both appease the sewer district, design a good stream that is offline from the pond, and I've got a little cross section here. We don't have any examples in the past few years. Summit County Metro Parks has a great example. I don't know if it's in Furnace Run. I can get you exactly where it is.
I'm just curious. So we're basically writing part of that book then on a technique that will be able to be replicated.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And we put a lot of thought into that technique so far, where that we can have Wolf Creek in a very attractive corridor, but then as we get flooded, it can spill over into the pond. So day to day, it doesn't flow through the pond, but when we get a storm event or flood event, it can overtop the banks and flood into the pond.
How do you keep the pond somewhat full?
Our next step is working on a hydrology analysis to make sure that we can keep the pond full, and then we will also look at tools like agri drains and agri gates, so that let's say we have an August with zero precipitation, we can just open up the gate from the creek, irrigate the pond, if you will, charge the pond, and then close the gate. Now, under most circumstances, there's enough natural drainage in and around Garfield, especially on the east side of the park, that the pond itself should stay charged. But we're going to design it both ways so that we have a plan B if we do have a drought condition. We are looking for some examples of how we can best design that interface between the pond and the creek. We've got some examples from Northeast Ohio, others from around the country. And then I want to walk you through what we're looking at in the other sections. So in that former upper pond area, we're looking at doing a stream restoration wetland complex where we can integrate the trail network and expose people to those wetlands and constructed wetlands. There are some existing wetlands there today that we would either enhance or protect. The program center we talked about, we have the ability here to do something very, very cool where we can house paddleboards, house kayaks, have our education program have a home base, if you will, and we can then program the patio outside of that for some instruction and some use and education. The boat launch area, this is where we can have either an ADA compliant kayak launch like we do at Rocky River, and some of those zero entry features where we bring down the barriers for getting people into the water and onto kayak and stand-up paddleboards. Fishing platforms, working hard to create accessible fishing platforms and perhaps even bring back that fly fishing casting pad that we saw in those late 1800s, early 1900s photos. So this is a very important component working with Mike Dirkblatt and our outdoor education and use that board program to have programmed fishing here at the pond. And then we talked about program spaces for education and to get people up to speed before we put anybody on the water. And also just for general park goers when they're enjoying the space when it's not being used for a program. So all in all these items potentially cost about $5 to $6 million. We just received $300,000 from the Ohio EPA through a 319 grant. That will help us make the first step in restoring Wolf Creek and some of the wetlands. We also received, Brian, you want to talk about the gift from?
Yeah, again, I think, you know, through a collaborative partnership with Ohio Cat, we received over $1 million worth of funding for this. Natalie Renane's first week on as the Chief Development Officer, we toured this. Commissioner Moore and I and others have been out there, including Sean Riley down Waskowitz, and a host of others that grew up in this area. And we're really looking forward to the continuation of bringing this project to fruition. And hopefully we can get more than 2.25 acres out of it.
So we have... I'll walk you through some of the next steps here. We have released a request for qualifications for designers who've got a focus on ecological restoration and stream improvements. We will have qualifications due back to us on the 30th. Our intent is to bring to you the recommendation to hire that consultant at the August board meeting. With the $300,000 granted from Ohio EPA, we would love to be under construction sometime at the end of 2021 on the stream restoration and wetland components. So we could start to make impact here at the park, perhaps do some clearing even before that. So we'll walk you through here. Stream and pond hydrology, we're working through that now, working through the permitting and stream district coordination. U.S. Army Corps has been fully supportive of this project. We had a very good meeting with them about a month ago. We're working through final concepts. We've released the professional design services RFQ. We're working on releasing the construction manager at risk RFQ. And then from there, we'll do the detailed renderings and cost estimating. We'll develop a firm pacing plan. As you heard from Brian, Natalie's working very hard on project fundraising, and then we will execute in a phased fashion.
Yeah, I guess not to be on, but it seems to me this model of adjacency on and stream would lend itself to a lot of restoration projects in other locations where the concerns about damming and other, you get that stagnation factor, interior ponds and other stuff.
So yeah, there is a good body of study on it, and we hope to add to that.
Yeah.
This is a great project, and it's just fantastic to see all the different departments contributing different components to it, and that's going to be a huge effect.
And rejuvenate that whole park.
It really does. The energy departments they have there, when we get to have planning meetings face to face, all the departments involved in the energy.
Yeah, I love that. That's
a the just looking through the forest is absolutely beautiful. It's to think of what they were thinking of initially and what's happened now. It's the real status.
Again, I appreciate everybody's hard work on this wonderful project, and this is one of those once-in-a-lifetime legacy opportunities to return this historic park. And Sean and I have some good-natured groups, just about, you know, the pond and the acreage and the size, and, you know, really trying to make sure that we do it the right way and to the best of our ability with the newest techniques. And we've talked about, you know, some other enhancements, but we know that people use the park, you know, on the outside, and they don't really travel through. So we really want to make sure by moving Iron Springs and adding the restrooms that we really are inviting people to that central part. And Christian Moore, it is beautiful in there. It's
well,
one of the most.
What
yep.
size would you want the pond to be, Brian?
100 acres.
The pond is
a little bit of a here.
We've got a gap.
The forest is absolutely incredible.
Very good. The next potential item we have is Huntington Reservation, just improvement update.
I'll be very brief on this one. We have been working very hard in Huntington with many departments here, putting in a lot of effort. So we've got our master plan. I know we're probably a bit tired of seeing all the master plans, but the point is that we are executing what we actually put on the master plans. We spend the time on these plans, and then we like to execute. Yes. So with that, we showed up the master plan and worked with the public with their feedback regarding the need for new restrooms and concessions, and then improving the drop-off zone here at Huntington. So that's exactly what we've done. We've planned the new restroom here. We've got the new drop-off area here. And then we have worked internally on the plans for those and through a contractor doing some work, and then our trade division doing the balance of the work. We are very close to opening up our new restrooms at Huntington. The craftsmanship here, again, is very, very good. Once we get clean water, make a little connection up here, we'll be ready to roll. So with the bathrooms now almost behind us, we can then start to concentrate on this next phase. And it's ambitious. Natalie and her team have been doing a great job. I believe we have almost a quarter million raised already, but we're looking at new concessions, re-siding the historic Huntington Water Tower, a picnic garden here with great views of the sunset, and then some swings. So I'll walk you through very quick. Here is the existing concession building and water tower. Looking back to a historic photo, we found that there was a pagoda-type structure that at one time was attached to the Huntington Water Tower. So we like to take clues from the past and modernize them. So Ryan Denker and his great skills came up with some ideas and renderings and working with operations on what a functional and modern concession operation would be. Hold on, I love this little transition. There you go. The sun is setting. Huntington is beautiful.
It's the lightning.
There you go. So we have, we've been working on final plans to get this portion of the project out to bid. In fact, on Monday, we'll be sending out for bid concession portions. Just to the east of that, we've got the ability for these proposed fire pits, this really cool picnic garden area where families can congregate, we can have seating, we can have the ability to catch the sunset. And we, you know, what we found in Edgewater and other areas is people, when they can, do love to congregate and have these very kind of rustic, but at the same time, intentional areas to have family gatherings and relax. We're also working just on the west side of the water tower on these swings. We have found East 55th at Euclid Beach at Edgewater that these swings are very popular, and also Natalie will hopefully have some success in finding specific donors who want to donate towards the construction of the swings. So with that, that's where we are on Huntington. We will be looking at implementing these improvements as a fun.
Thank you, Sean. As Sean leaves the room, Stephanie Cusco is now coming in to give the 2019 real estate report. A long-awaited 2019 real estate report.
Yes, good morning, commissioners, and it does feel a bit odd, you know, presenting 2019 when we're halfway through 2020, but I'm glad we get to do it because there's a lot of positive things that happened in 2019, a big year of accomplishments, so definitely worth highlighting, and I think we could all use some, you know, positive news right now. So just to kind of dive in, the report contains all of our acquisitions in 2019 and then summarizes our current acreage by, you know, reservation, by city, by county, by watershed. We highlight each of those acquisitions, and then we also talk a little bit about some of the projects we've worked on this year as well. So this map details all of the properties that we've acquired in 2019. You can see they span, you know, the park system pretty well. We've got acquisitions in the east, the south, the west, and then also, you know, they're right in the core of our more of our urban park. We completed 26 transactions, which totaled 217 acres. And the interesting thing about those transactions is 12 of them were located within the city of Cleveland. So, you know, really illustrating our desire to be present in our urban core, providing quality green space for, you know, all of our residents. Yeah. This brought our total acres up to 23,822. Currently today in 2020, we are at 23,965. So we do hope by the end of the year, we will surpass that 24,000 that we've talked so long about. Of the 217 acres, 45 of the acres were donated, and those were valued at over $9.7 million. The remaining acres was purchased, and that purchase amount totaled $9,700,000, so pretty much a 50-50 split between purchase and donations. But of that $9 million, we had nearly $6 million covered by grant funds. So 60% of our purchase was covered by grant funds. So you're looking at 20% was Cleveland Metro Parks Fund, 30% donations, and 50%, I mean 30% grants, 50% donations. So in total, we acquired nearly $20 million in land. So, you know, it was a big year. We also acquired parkland in 12 separate communities and 10 of our reservations. And these were really quality acquisitions. We preserved over 10,000 feet of headwater streams and nearly 2,000 feet of rivers and creeks. We acquired over 3.4 miles of trails, either with existing or future trail connections. And we protected over 67 acres of wetlands and forests as well. Yeah, so I want to dive into each acquisition a little bit, just kind of highlight some of, you know, those different properties and, you know, why they're important to the park. We're going to start with the properties that were grant funded. And so this is South Sugar Reservation. And you can see here, this is a picture of the Jackson and Ellerin properties. The Jackson property is 73 acres, long been identified as a property for us for acquisition. We were able to secure a grant from WRSP in the amount of $4.15 million. So, enabled to take that grant, and then we used it as match to acquire the Ellerin property, which is about 15 acres. So, in total, this little block here is about 88 acres, really high quality property. There's tributaries to the Aurora Branch and Chagrin River. You know, Category 3 wetlands, Class 3 headwater streams, so quality property. In applying to these grants, we put together a quick video, so I just want to share that with you right now so you can get a feel for the property. So these are just some of the aerial views that, you know, were taken of the property. We like to put these together as a grant source. You know, it's nice to get a good visual of what we're preserving. As you can see, 25 acres of Category 3 wetlands. This property actually scored highest in the state for all the WRSP acquisitions. Mm-hmm. It's a very competitive grant source, so we felt really good about that. Over 2,300 linear feet of Class 3 primary arrow stream. So definitely a high quality natural resource type property. 80 acres of forest. Now the music kicks in. But I just wanted to give you a feel, you know, a little more visual of what some of these properties look like. All right, so moving to Euclid Creek Reservation, this has been a long looked at property. It's always been on kind of our long range plan to try and acquire. We call this the Cahovanian Highland Ridge property. It's 63 acres. This was grant funded through the Clean Ohio Conservation Fund. It's a very important acquisition. You can see, you know, this entire block grew the entire Euclid Creek Reservation by over 10%. So it connects a lot of those neighborhoods and communities kind of up above Euclid Creek Gorge down into the main body of the Euclid Creek Reservation. It is the single largest acquisition in Euclid Creek's history, with the exception of when they added the lakefront to Euclid Creek. And it's an important acquisition because 9% of the Euclid Creek watershed is green space. So they're really kind of lacking quality parks in this area. So we felt really great about this one. And now you can kind of see this is the span between Brexter Reservation and Mill Stream Run Reservation. You got Seneca Golf Course there. We were able to pick up this property through donation. The next couple properties I'm going to talk about are donated properties. So the city of Burlington approached us about donating this property. It's 15 acres And it really connects that property down into Rexall Reservation with that all purpose trail that's highlighted there in purple. We also received a donation from Petros Development. This is an 8-acre property, and you know, it's kind of set aside green space as part of a proposed development. And it really helps, you know, expand that kind of long linear portion of the park, protect some wetlands and some forests. And then moving over to Bradleywood Reservation, this is another donation from a developer. Breeze Homes was proposing a development here. So they donated a conservation easement that's nearly 4 acres. It protects a lot of wetlands, buffers that swamp forest that we know, you know, exists here in Bradleywood. We also received a private donation from a family, a local family. You can see all the names there, Donald, Frank, Madden, Sylvie, and Coon. So they wanted to donate this as a legacy for their family. And it's right there next to the Panovanian property that I just reviewed. And gives, you know, again, that it sits above the Euclid Creek Gorge and just gives the opportunity to connect the residents down into the main body of the reservation. And we're back here into Brexall. So this is the property that was donated from North Royalston, but you can see we didn't have that connection out to Bennett Road. So we were able to pick up the Rodriguez property, about 3 acres. And that really got us, you know, from Royalston Road out to Bennett, down into Brexall and connect to the larger portion of the park. And then we also acquired in Brexall Reservation the Ivo property. So this is nearly 8 acres. Kind of in holding along Parkview Road. It's bordered by not only us, but the national park. So again, another just good opportunity to kind of buffer the park. And now we're moving to Bedford Reservation. So just north of Bedford Reservation is Dunham Park, which we acquired just a number of years ago. It had a very narrow entrance off of Shriver Road. So this acquisition really let us kind of expand upon that entrance. You know, it'll be a more inviting way to enter the park, a little bit more visual to our park visitors. And then over on this side, we have the Sharma, the Moat property, which was along the west branch of the Rock River. It's a 1-acre property, and it really filled kind of an inholding. It was a triangle piece that was surrounded by the park. The surrounding park properties were purchased in like the 1920s and 30s. So it's just this inholding that's existed for many, many years, and it's, you know, an opportunity to pick it up and kind of pull back up. So a lot of our acquisitions weren't just, you know, preservation-based, they were for trails and specifically tiger trails. So we, you know, started these acquisitions back in 2018 and continued through 2019 picking up essential pieces to connect, for example, the first one, Lundy Park Bridge. So we acquired 0.2 acres. This was with the City of Cleveland both through easements and encroachment permits. And, you know, this is the bridge that'll link the Cleveland Foundation Centennial Trail to Lundy Park. So, you know, very essential small acquisitions like getting people across that area there. And then so far in 2020, actually just this week, we acquired the remaining interest from Norfolk Southern. And then Whiskey Island, another part of the Tiger Trails, this links Wendy Park to Edgewater Park. This is a 1.3 mile trail that we needed to acquire some property to make it happen. We worked with the Cleveland Cuyahoga County Port Authority, both through an easement and a sublease, as well as an easement with the City of Cleveland.
Who is that? Is that trail, just go back one.
Mm-hmm.
So that trail is down, further down the slope.
Yeah, so the yellow line here is, yeah, is the trail.
It's being built up. It's actually going to be kind of towed into it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so the Port Authority allowed us to use that.
Mostly the railroad, actually.
And then also part of Tiger Trails is the Red Line Greenway. So this actually added quite a bit of acreage here. It's in total 11 acres. The most of the real estate came from the Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority easement, as well as lease with ODOT, and then some smaller easement pieces with Lock Industrial, the City of Cleveland. So in addition to some of those, you know, trail projects and real, you know, high quality preservation projects, we started a partnership with some local land banks, both Cuyahoga Land Bank and City Land Bank, to try and really identify, you know, where are these properties and adjacent to our park. So we worked closely with their staff and our GIS teams, and we kind of overlaid our layers to see where do they have property holdings in relation to our park. and, you know, where opportunities that we can acquire for properties. So this map is just an example. We did this for each of the reservations. The red is city land bank, the yellow is county land bank. And we really just tried to create a map for each and to help prioritize where some of these acquisitions might be. So this year we kind of saw the fruits of our labor and we closed on 4 transactions, which totaled 4.1 acres. And a number of reservations, so we worked with the city of Garfield Heights Land Bank in Bedford and Garfield. And then we also worked with the Cuyahoga County Land Bank to reserve some acreage in Garfield and Washington. Yes, it's great to see that come together because it's been a long process, but the staff has been great to work with, and even through 2020, we're still continuing to acquire more land-based properties. And the last acquisition I'm going to talk about is this Cuyahoga County property. This is the narrow span along Ohio and Erie Canal Reservation. Our management center was leased with the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District. That term was coming up, and we needed to identify a new place for a management center. So Cuyahoga County was working to disposition some of their properties. This property came up as an opportunity, and we really looked at it as, you know, it's a great location, it's centrally located, it's in that narrow stretch, and it really gave us an opportunity to expand some more operations. So now this will be the future home of not only the Ohio and Erie Canal Management Center, but also for trails, for mobile outreach, for visual communication. So really a great opportunity to pick up a, you know, a property and kind of have a new home for our management center. So this is just kind of summarizes all our acreage for each reservation, community, and county. So we added acreage in 10 reservations in 12 different communities, and all of which this year were in Cuyahoga County. And then we updated our numbers as well across the watershed scale. We really saw the biggest increase in the Cuyahoga River watershed this year. And then we just wanted to update you a little bit on some of the projects we've been working on. All of this, you know, 100 years of data is stored in a real estate database. And we were utilizing a Microsoft Access database, which is kind of old and archaic. And we really wanted to find something that was more user-friendly and, you know, could sustain time and really be a little bit more server-based. So we worked with our IT services department, and they helped us develop a new database to house. It houses all our deeds, so we have over 1,700 deeds, over 1,500 agreements. And so this is how we kind of do these reports each year, how much acres, which community, which reservation. But it also helps us track important things like a lot of our leases have terms, or a lot of our acquisitions have restrictions, either grant restrictions or deed restrictions. And then all of our agreements too, you know, we have a lot of easements for sewers or driveways or water lines. So this has been a great accomplishment that we have this new,
Put everything on kind of a calendar.
Yep, there's terms in each year of what expires. So I can type in 2020 and find out every term. So it's been super helpful, and we're really glad to have it. And then we also looked at land protection planning. You know, a lot of times real estate can be reactionary if something hits the market, but we want to get ahead of it too. So we kind of looked back at some of the plans that have been developed over previous years. And we wanted to look at, you know, of those plans, what has been acquired, what remains a priority, you know, what might no longer be of interest or is no longer available, and then also identifying new opportunities. So we worked with T&D and our GIS team to query some properties that were in close proximity to us that have more of a substantial acreage. But then we also realized that kind of missed some properties because, you know, if it's just in connection to us, then we're not looking at new initiatives. So we also queried all open space that was greater than 50 acres that had some green space component to it. And we tried to develop sort of a scoring system to kind of evaluate this property. So just updating plans that we have, trying to identify new initiatives, but also helping us evaluate them. We often bring properties to the board to look at, and we really want to make sure we have all the information available to us. So,
and you get all the data and
right.
Who owns what?
Exactly. And so that long list on the left there are all different layers that you can turn on and off. So you have like your base data, like aerial, community boundaries, contours, but then you kind of dive into the natural resources, like terrestrial specimens. And then we look at connections. So we looked at all the trail plans that are out there, And then, you know, connections that we have identified in plans, as well as things like hydrology and other protected land. So, for example, like we have West Creek Conservancies, all their property on there. Western Reserve Land Conservancy, the properties on there, corridors, land use, all that. So, yeah, it's been really helpful to help us, you know, identify properties of interest. And then we wanted to make sure we weren't just looking at properties that were like just high quality natural resources. We also looked for park need. So we used the TPL park score, as well as our walk bike shed layer. So all of those can be turned on and off and then used for value. Exactly. So as we, you know, wrap up the decade, we want to look at, you know, some other opportunities that we've been able to have over the years. And starting with reservations, we acquired two new reservations in the past 10 years, both Acacia and the Lakefront. And we were able to acquire land in 16 of the 18 reservations. So the only two reservations that we didn't acquire land in were Brookside and Huntington.
Brookside and what?
Huntington? Yep. So we've really, you know, been able to touch on each reservation over the past 10 years, with the exception of those two. And then communities, we currently serve 48 communities. In the past 10 years, we've added two new communities, Windhurst and Maple Heights. And then we added acres in 27 of those 48 communities. And this is just a quick snapshot of all the acres over the past 10 years, which totals just over 2,500 acres. So just going year by year, and I won't, you know, go through each and every one of these, but there are a number of acquisitions here, some being large in size. You know, so we have Seneca Golf Course, Acacia, the Lakefront Reservation, Afterhurst Park, you know, our big acquisitions. But then we have the smaller ones that are very significant, like Rivergate Park and Heritage Park. And then lastly, those important connections. So the Mill Creek Connector Trail, the Cleveland Foundation Centennial Trail, the West Creek Greenway, those types of things as well. So interestingly enough, we ended 2019 with the highest amount of real transactions that we've had in over 20 years. The last time we had this many transactions was when we were putting together Ohio and Erie Canal Reservation. And then just as a summary for the decade, again, I said we acquired over 2,500 acres, and that was valued at over $133 million. So, yeah, something good to look back on. So normally we would end here, but I figured since we're, you know, halfway through 2020, I'd give you a little snapshot into where we're at today. Yes. So between January and July of this year, we have acquired 144 acres so far in 9 separate transactions. We are expected to close on an additional 6 properties. So we'll probably be up around that 15 transaction mark, and acquired a total of about probably 287 acres. So we hope to be, again, over that 24,000 acre mark at the end of the year.
Right.
But that's
amazing. All that other work too of cataloging everything and just having it in
database. It's fun to look back on it, you know. I mean, 2019 was busy, so we're like, oh, this is why.
Yeah.
We had a record year, so.
We
want
that while we're closing down these things. And yeah. Moving forward.
Well, we appreciate you guys' support. Thank you.
Excellent work.
Can I ask a question? On the Garfield plot, that you covered before, you mentioned that it was leased from the city. How did, and I guess so does the Coast Guard say, how does that work? In other words, do we bring capital improvements in?
Yep.
Is there some way we protect it from just having it taken back?
Yes, the answer is the intricacies of the land donations, much similar to, I can speak to the zoo, to Brookside, to Seneca, to the lakefront leases, Garfield, very similarly is on a 100-year lease. And so essentially it's You know, through ownership in perpetuity, it does come over the land donation. So, you know, the partnership that we've had with the City of Cleveland, you know, we'd like to continue with maybe with other properties, you know, along the way. But the Park District is very well protected in the green space arena that we've acquired from the City of Cleveland.
Did they have the right to approve?
No. No. No, from 86 all the way through. In fact, none of them come encumbered with anything. They're under the auspices of the Park Commissioners. That is the last info item. And again, I echo the sentiments. I mean, fantastic work by the real estate team to continue to preserve the legacy of the Metro Parks and continuing to grow throughout the last number of years is very impressive. There is no old business. The next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, August 20th, 8 o'clock.
Yeah, and I'd just like to thank the real estate team too, Kyle and Stephanie, and now our new team member, Dana. They're just incredible. They work really hard, and we're a little short-staffed, and now we have a lot of encroachments coming up, so all of these things play into it, but their round-the-clock diligence is just so impressive. And now, do we have a motion to go into executive session? We have had a few real estate issues come up. And other issues specifically, is there a motion to go into executive session for the purposes of acquiring real estate and also collective bargaining discussion?
Second.
Roll call.
Bruce Richter?
Yes.
Debbie Berry?
Yes.
Dan